Have you gone to 10,000 Christmas parties?
10,000 Christmas parties? I don't know. I we've been kind of Christmas party averse. RSV has become RSVP. We're like, no, we'd love to come, but we can't. Can't do it.
Well played, Evan. Well played.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Evan Osnos, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Susan Glasser and Jane Mayer. Hi to you both.
Hey there, Evan.
Hey, Evan.
Well, we're nearing the end of 2022, which could be described in all kinds of ways, but I think the central fact is that this was the year when a post-pandemic world started to heave into view. Obviously, the coronavirus is still with us, but the year was dominated by upheavals in economics and big shifts in foreign affairs, inflation, war. All of that is going to shape the year ahead. And so today we're going to talk about what we thought the biggest stories of 2022 were and why we think they're important. Plus, it wouldn't be a year-end special without a list of our favorite things, but we'll get to that in just a moment. Jane, let's start with you. What do you think the biggest story of the year was?
Well, I mean, it's always impossible to really say things like this, but from my standpoint, from politics, I think it was the Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case overturning Roe v. Wade. I think it's just been an earthquake in America. For women across the country, this is just, laying down the beginning of an incredible fight, taking away somebody's rights. After years of the women's movement, allowing women to move forward and take control of their own lives, it is just an incredible slap in the face. And so I think, from my standpoint, that was the story of the year.
Susan, a lot of things get described as earthquakes in Washington, but as Jane described, that certainly seems to fit the moment we just experienced. In all of the years that you've spent in Washington, is there anything you can think of that really compares to this ruling?
I mean, look, this is a once in a generation type political event, as well as being a social and cultural transformation that we're watching happen. We weren't around for Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. This is a kind of inverse moment to that, or to the original Roe decision itself in 1973. Evan, this is going to have, and already is having, enormous impact on women's lives. It's also continuing and exacerbating the cleavage of America into two different countries. If you consider the right to control your own body, reproductive rights, to be a human right, then why is it that your human rights don't exist in large swaths of the country now, and they do in other parts? And so I think, unfortunately, it's not only having a terrible direct impact on many, many women around the country, but it is actually creating the physical reality of separate Americas.
I think I totally agree, and I think also it's hastened the just the cratering of faith in the Supreme Court and in the rule of law and in the fairness of the laws. I mean, I think what it's made people realize is that the Supreme Court is a political institution. It's the third branch of government, and that there's been years worth of an effort to try to stack the court with people who have, at this point, a minority opinion on such issues as abortion rights, and that they will then impose their views on the rest of the country. And then again, the way this story broke, I think, was fascinating. I mean,
I want to ask you about that. The leak itself, sometimes it's easy to forget about it now because the impact of the policy is so profound. But the sheer fact of the leak is quite remarkable. I mean, this had almost never happened. But what do you think the current state-of-the-art thinking is, Jane, about how it leaked? And do you think we'll ever know exactly?
My general feeling after too many years in Washington is that very few things stay secrets. I don't think we know exactly, and what we're left with is surmises and speculation. But the speculation seems to have grown after originally people thinking it must have come from the left, from the pro-choice camp. I would say that there's sort of a growing consensus that it came from the right, and it was probably a strategic effort on somebody's part to see if they couldn't bring Roberts over to support the opinion of the other anti-choice justices in this decision.
Susan, do you think this is something that we're going to be dealing with in the next few months, in the year ahead? Or is this a story that's kind of more confined to the Dobbs decision?
The question of, the internal divisions on the court, the institutional integrity of the court, these are the kinds of stories I think that we're going to see more and more of as it becomes under this enormous pressure and the veil of secrecy, even on this most opaque of American institutions, begins to be ripped off, not least by our beloved Jane here, who, I would bet on Jane in any reporting project, which she's now undertaking.
Thanks, Susan.
Around an institution
it's
like that.
Absolutely. It's an inscrutable institution. It's hard to break in, which is, and really report on the inside, which is, I guess, again, why the leak was such a phenomenal story. If there was a story that I wish I'd been able to break, this year, I wish I'd been able to be Josh Gerstein and Alexander Ward, who were the co-authors of the Politico piece that came out and just dropped like a bombshell in Washington. And the thing about the leak, I mean, there have been other sort of premature leaks of a couple other opinions, including the original Roe opinion in 1973. But what was astounding about this was they had the entire Alito draft. And there it was for everybody to read in advance. It's just an incredible breach of the protocol of the court. I would argue, as a reporter, the more information you get, the better. I'm pro leak. but that's certainly not the way that the court is looking at it. And they're supposedly still doing a serious investigation.
You know, I'm interested, Jane, in the fact that there is the long-term legacy of the Dobbs decision, which is one thing. And then there's the long-term legacy for the court of becoming increasingly associated with being a political actor. This notion that it was ever a kind of priestly body that was somehow kind of separated from politics, that idea, to the degree it ever existed in the popular consciousness, seems to be pretty much dead now. As you think about the court, both how to write about it and also the role it plays in Washington, does it now more or less play the role of another political combatant, whether it wants to be or not?
I mean, I think inevitably it does. And part of the reason is that we've watched with our mouths agape and written about the role that the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas has played, Ginni Thomas, during this last year in being an active proponent of Biden's election win. I mean, a supporter of Trump in his big lie. I mean, it's impossible to separate the justices from politics when their wives are up to their eyeballs in it.
Well, I think one point that's important to make is that this is the Donald Trump Supreme Court. We have rarely seen the transformation in such a short amount of time of the court, which over its history has actually been much more stable. And in fact, in just a few years, starting with right before Trump came into office, Mitch McConnell's refusal to allow a hearing on Merrick Garland, you had the appointment in a short amount of time then of three justices who basically transformed the institution. So you had John Roberts. Now you have him presiding over as Chief Justice, by any measure, an activist, radical court. And that is the Donald Trump court. And for many people, especially the kind of white evangelical Christians who were the unlikely core of support for Donald Trump in both 2016 and 2020, that's vindication. They might find him to be a morally loathsome creature, but he has accomplished in a very short amount of time what they spent decades seeking to achieve, which was the overturning of Roe versus Wade.
And that may be an ingredient in the murky political calculus about whether this guy could ever come back, because he did deliver for some portion of his base. And I think when we look at Trump's his political viability, we look, well, this guy is every day looks to be less and less electable, unless, of course, you're an evangelical Christian voter who says, no, that was a slam dunk.
Well, so, Evan, there's so much to talk about in American politics. We sometimes forget that Washington is the epicenter of, kind of global uncertainty and instability. And, I'm wondering where that leaves you reflecting at the end of the year in terms of our big story.
I think that the story that returns to me most is one that we're going to be talking about not just in the year ahead, but I think in the decade and beyond, and that is this transformation in the Washington consensus on the subject of China. Really, in a sort of an astonishingly brief period of time, we've seen the rise of this rare point of agreement between Democrats and Republicans that the fundamental approach to engaging China, which had been in place for a generation or two, this idea of cooperation, maybe wary cooperation and openness, but that that has just failed, that that policy is sort of non-functional. And instead of a China that looks more like us politically and economically and is kind of inching its way into the international system, that we're now contending with something that is much more committed to its own approach. You know, there was a moment towards the end of the year when Xi Jinping used this expression where he described the Chinese solution, the Zhongguo Fang'an, the idea that they represent an alternative to Western liberal democracy. And I think in Washington, you really can't overstate, as you guys know, you can't overstate how big a sea change that is.
Can I just say, I can never hear enough of Evan speaking Chinese. I mean...
lousy tones, I'm afraid. Lousy tones. We'll just have to suffer through.
We have been talking, though, Evan, about this sort of, you know, pivot to China and this shift in Washington thinking about China for a number of years. Why do you think this year in particular marked an inflection point?
Yeah, that's, you're right, Susan. This phase began a few years ago. I mean, I think it began mostly with the rise of Xi Jinping, came to power in 2012, and he initiated a whole series of things, which we now know. He began to lock up a lot of his political opponents under the banner of going after corruption. He sort of shut down civil society, began to more aggressively pursue China's claims in the South China Sea and also over Taiwan, which has become, in the American consciousness, I think, a kind of new frontier of this confrontation between open societies and closed societies. You know, what will the United States do on Taiwan? And in 2022, you had these extraordinary moments. You had the U.S. President Joe Biden saying that he was willing to risk American life to defend Taiwan, which is just a bombshell in terms of how China thinks about these things. But I think there was another piece of this, and you've thought a lot about this, Susan, which is that the war in Ukraine actually had an impact on how we think about China, because China and Vladimir Putin signed what they called a no-limits partnership just a few days before Russia invaded Ukraine. And I think that was a crystallizing moment for a lot of people in American government and in politics to say, well, hold on, it's not just Putin as this rogue independent figure. Does he in fact have the moral support of China and maybe more than that? That begins to change how we think about contending with that threat to our own security in the years ahead.
Evan, I think the question is whether there have been some limits on it since then. We have not seen China, shipping anti-aircraft batteries to Russia and the like. And so I do think it's a big moment, but I want to like push back though. I mean, wouldn't the Trump people say that this is their big legacy? Actually, was the one area where there was almost a bipartisan consensus that we had got to go in a different direction with China and be much tougher and much more aware.
They would argue that the first steps were taken under Trump. The Obama administration would say, actually, no, the change was underway under us. I mean, this is, success, as we know, in Washington has many, many press releases, if not parents. I think the other thing to your point, I 100% agree with you that we've seen in some ways some of the limits of what China is willing to do in terms of supporting Russia. And that's a theme that comes through in 2022 is the delineation of boundaries, kind of the sort of the end of the ambiguity on some of these big questions. I mean, this is partly about what the U.S. is willing to do on Taiwan. The policy for years, as you know, was called the strategic ambiguity policy, which is a little terrifying when you're talking about nuclear powers, but it was useful. It worked. We would never say exactly what we would do if China invaded Taiwan, and China wouldn't say ultimately exactly what would prompt it to invade. And that ambiguity allowed it to remain a cold war instead of a hot war. This year, we began to draw some of those lines more explicitly, which is it's a choice. It's a perilous choice, but it also may be the right choice if it means that it forces China to recognize that there are consequences.
I feel as if this is one of those topics where there might be a huge gap between what you hear in Washington and what you hear in the rest of the country. I mean, when you are in Washington and going to sort of you know, high-level dinners and policy discussions, it seems like almost a foregone conclusion that we are basically moving towards almost a hot war of some sort, potentially, against China. I don't know. I feel Washington's racing ahead in this direction. What do you think?
Yeah, I confess there are moments when I really worry about some of the muscle memory kicking in Washington, that we have these reflexes. You know, everybody kind of kicks into gear. The white papers get written. The think tanks convene. The panels happen. It's the same question that starts off every dinner party is, you know, what do you think is going to happen on Taiwan? And that has a kind of momentum of its own that can be really treacherous, actually. One of the things, Jane, that you talked about when we first started this podcast, one of the things you hoped we would do was talk about sort of what's happening behind the visible part of the politics. And I think there's an example of that that's kind of interesting on the China issue, which is that the biggest change is not what politicians are talking about in front of the microphone. The biggest change is inside the boardrooms and inside the business community, that you have companies that had basically assumed that the future for them was in China. It was just going to be, might be a little hard to settle in, but that was going to be the future. That's where 1.5 billion people are. And now there's been this real change, and really a sort of division within the business community, companies that still are making a lot of money there, places like Apple, and other companies like Google that have figured out, okay, no, that's not part of our future. We have to go separate ways. That has huge political implications because it means that that's who they back different kinds of people in politics. They push different kinds of policies in secret. They do different things that end up having real effect on the future of this tremendously important relationship.
Are you expecting the Republicans in the House, in the new majority in the House, to be very hawkish about China?
Yes. I think there really is no outer bound now among conservatives on how hawkish you can be. You've already heard Mike Pompeo say that, in effect, calling on the Chinese people to declare their own government illegitimate. You're about to get a foot race about how hawkish you can possibly be. And that's something, frankly, that we should be watching with real wariness. Susan, somehow you always manage to keep one eye on domestic politics with tremendous intensity and on the rest of the world. I'm curious, what do you think is the biggest story of the year?
Well, look, Evan, I think that there is a striking story that doesn't get nearly the attention, oddly, that it should. And this might be weird to frame it in this way, but we are talking about a year in which the largest land war since World War II has broken out in Europe. And it's like an afterthought in, you know, Washington conversations, as much as there's been this extraordinary mobilization, you know, of billions and billions of dollars worth of aid to Ukraine. And yet I think, you know, to Jane's point about the rest of the country, people somehow are oddly disconnected from this convulsion, and it is a convulsion. And it should be the occasion for an enormous amount of soul searching on the part of American policymakers and politicians about failure. This is a story of monumental failure, not only by the United States, but the rest of the West. That's the only way I can describe it. And look, we're talking about millions and millions of Ukrainians who are bearing the price for that. Tens of thousands, if not ultimately, it will be hundreds of thousands dead. I mean, we're really just talking about a kind of a cataclysmic event.
So far, the support for Ukraine in the United States has been bipartisan, right? To a large extent, with a little bit of carping here and there. Do you think, Susan, that that's going to hold up?
Well, I think, look, first of all, there has been the emergence of what you might even call a pro-Putin faction in the Republican Party, led by Donald Trump, Tucker Carlson on Fox News night after night, Elon Musk, the new owner of Twitter. You have a significant minority, not a majority, but minority faction of the Republican Party, and it's been growing. But in the short term, I don't see any breaking of this coalition that has been funneling these breathtaking amounts of military aid and weapons and supplies to Ukraine. We are essentially mounting a proxy war in Ukraine. The funneling of so far $66 billion and counting, there's a new $37 billion more that was attached to the end of year spending bill. NATO has been resurrected, its mission. Sweden and Finland have joined this alliance against Russia that literally decades and centuries of neutrality have been abandoned because of this war. But Putin is banking on us over the longer term losing our will, over the longer term giving up the zeal to fight, and cracks appearing in the coalition.
In some ways, you're hinting at the political endgame in American terms. I'm curious, though, what you make of the strategic endgame, in the actual fight on the ground.
Well, the fear among a lot of close observers of the war is that it won't be over. And remember that for Ukraine, this war, as they see it, began in 2014. And that's one of the biggest friction points. And one of the deeply held views in Ukraine, which I think we need to take more account of, is the idea that Washington and Western capitals' great failure was not a failure in February of this year, but a failure to all the years between 2014 and 2022 that led up to that moment. So they see the beginning of the war when Putin illegally annexed and occupied Crimea. And essentially, we let him back into the club of world leaders without more than what he saw as an acceptable price, a slap on the wrist. And that almost certainly informed the disastrous calculation that he made that he could go ahead and do this again. I don't think people should be looking for any kind of global settlement of this conflict anytime soon.
I'm also struck, Susan, that, you know, here we are at a time where people are considering bracing for the possibility of a nuclear attack. And yet somehow it's not even the first story that we talk about every day.
Well, that's right, Evan. It's the return of a kind of nuclear blackmail into our lives that essentially had disappeared over the last few decades since you and I were children. I mean, we grew up with this fear in our bones. And then with the end of the Cold War, we let it go. It's almost like this sort of collective, like, let's just pretend, you know, that isn't a problem. And I have never envisioned some of the conversations I've had with senior folks inside and outside the U.S. government over the last few months. You know, they are sitting at the table in the Situation Room in the White House, and they are working through scenarios for what do we do if there is this kind of nuclear strike inside Ukraine, and what is the U.S. response? And those are the kinds of conversations that have not been had since the end of the Cold War. So I think that's another thing that 2022 is going to go down for in the history books, unfortunately.
Maybe we, the press, haven't really done our part in explaining this. You know, there's as we've all said, a sort of tendency towards isolationism, especially an inward turning since the pandemic. And, you know, maybe we haven't really explained what the stakes are, even for Americans in some ways.
I mean, one of the really remarkable things, actually kind of an encouraging demonstration of political possibility in the United States, was the way that Americans, I mean, regular people, got involved, got invested in the idea of Ukraine protecting itself. People way up in rural Maine who are putting Ukraine flags.
The flags
on their
are everywhere.
Houses.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
What do you guys think explains that?
I think it's a kind of a David and Goliath story, partly. I mean, it's partly also about democracy. I mean, we identify with the democracies that are fighting to stay free against the madness of autocrats.
Yeah, I think that I agree with that. I think it's a great insight. Vladimir Putin also is almost talk about a cartoon villain for the American people. For two decades, right, they've seen this image of, you know, the kind of the bad guy, riding bare chested on horseback, invading small countries with a flick of his, finger in the Kremlin, not necessarily anything more than a caricature in terms of how this really happened. This is a resurrection of a long tradition, a long history of Russian imperial conquest, right? It's not some crazy outlier whim just of one man, unfortunately. You know, for two decades, essentially, that's what we've been doing, is a cycle of reproving him for outrages against the international order and then forgetting about it. In some ways, right, that's how we, too, have been in this cycle of enabling and creating the dictator. It's also fascinating in Washington, right? Evan talked about kind of the grand industrial scale think tank panels and papers are our contribution to the national GDP. But people are, they want to focus on the future rather than the present. it's easier in some ways to revert to these kind of theoretical debates over the future unknowns dealing with Xi Jinping than the actual present of this terrible conflict.
Well, not to be too cynical, but isn't it also a booming business to be producing war armaments? Defense manufacturers just seem to grow and grow and grow, and the budget for the Defense Department grows and grows and grows. Am I being too cynical to think that
maybe that plays
a part in all of this?
It certainly does. Also, the industry of people who bloviate around that topic. And that is, unfortunately, a kind of dubious business that's worth us calling out. The political scene will be back in just a moment with some of our favorite things from 2022. Stick around.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Well, it is time for the year-end lists about some of our favorite things, and they may or may not have anything to do with politics. This is a chance for us to go off the range here. Jane, why don't you go first?
Thanks. Okay, I had a very hard time picking. I was sort of torn between one of my favorite novels that I read this year, Horse by Geraldine Brooks, which was fantastic. I highly recommend it. The Edward Hopper show at the Whitney, which I also thought was wonderful. But I ended up with something that I just saw that I think is a lot less well known, which was a dramatization just last week of a book called East West Street by Philippe Sands, who is an international human rights lawyer. And the production is called A Song of Good and Evil. And I totally recommend reading Philippe Sands' book, East West Street. It's part detective story. It's an investigation by a human rights lawyer about how the horrors of the Holocaust in World War II in the town that his family came from, which is now in Ukraine, Lviv, became the origins of the two most important concepts in human rights law now, which is the law of genocide and the law of crimes against humanity. The lawyers that came up with those ideas, along with Philippe Sands, who's also a tremendous human rights lawyer, all three of them came from this one tiny city.
Wow.
And the story that he tells is about how their families were wiped out and how their concepts became key to the Nuremberg trial and eventually the conviction of Hans Frank, who oversaw the Jewish extermination in Poland. Anyway, it's a great twisted tale about families, about huge concepts in human rights and history and of good and evil. And it ends with a great song from Leonard Cohen, from Anthem.
Can't go wrong ending on Leonard Cohen, that's for sure.
So, Evan, it's hard to top that one. What have you been reading and watching and thinking about this
year? Well, I have to say, I was listening to Jane's just terrific presentation and thinking, I guess this is what life is like once our kids are out of the house. It sounds pretty amazing. All of these plays and shows. But the thing I actually want to mention has absolutely nothing to do with politics, which is a documentary that I challenge you not to remember and recommend, which is called The Rescue. And it is made by the filmmakers who made Free Solo and Miru. It's a couple named Jimmy Chin and Shai Vasarely. They specialize in these movies about kind of adventure and bravery and testing the limits of human capability. And this movie is about that story that we all heard a bit about in 2018 when those kids, a soccer team, were trapped underground in Thailand. It turns out that the movie of how they got out, this extraordinary documentary that manages to be both artistically bold and interesting and just a hell of a tale about ingenuity, is fascinating and has, I will confess, one political element that is irresistible, which is that people will remember that Elon Musk at one point announced that he was going to ride in and engineer a way of saving these kids, and it didn't work. And what ended up working actually was this much more ground-up, grassroots, quirky, eccentric improvisation by a bunch of people who had spent years of their lives passionately involved in swimming around caves, of all things. And here it was. And they saved just a kind of uncountable, unimaginable tragedy. And that's a great way to end the year.
Susan, what were your favorites from the year?
Well, you know, you and I, Jane, have talked about that great book, East West Street, before, and I highly endorse your endorsement of it. Of course, with this year, if you want to understand what's happening behind the increasingly opaque Iron Curtain that Putin has constructed for himself, I definitely highly recommend the extraordinary documentary Navalny, which looks at the now imprisoned dissident. That is just one of the best films, you know, to my mind, of recent years. I mean, it's literally got footage of Navalny after he's been poisoned, remember, and he goes to Germany. His life is saved in a very unlikely way. He then chooses to go back to Russia, facing almost certain imprisonment. They're on the plane with him as it makes its dramatic landing in Moscow. And he's dragged off the plane, of course, and into prison, from which he has not yet emerged and may well never emerge.
And the documentary is called Navalny, right?
Navalny.
The documentary is called Navalny. Of course, that meant I had to read a lot of fiction to escape from things over the last year. I just finished reading a book I highly recommend by the new Nobel laureate for literature, Abdulrazak Gurna, called Afterlives. It's a terrific book about East Africa in between World War I and World War II. Love that book. Yeah, so for my final, you know, kind of thought, the book that I really would recommend is one that I've gone back to and reread for the first time since I first read it, probably in high school, which is David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest. And as a sort of, you know, cri de coeur about a Washington screw-up for the ages, and what happens when smart people do bad things and don't get it right. The Halberstam book, it is brilliant, and it spoke to me. In this moment of, you know, just sort of catastrophic screwing up, you know, including by a lot of well-intentioned, smart people.
Yeah.
It feels like a book for our time.
It's a real message of hubris, isn't it?
Totally. And
you know, something to keep in mind as we cover Washington and for ourselves, too.
Well, I think we have managed to cover every conceivable human endeavor in that list right there, from the most bleak to the most soaring. And I think it's a perfect way to end this year. It's been an extraordinary year for writing, for reading, and for joining you guys every week. This has been a real treat. So thanks for all we've done over the last few weeks and months, and looking forward to a new year ahead.
You too.
Oh, thank you guys. I feel so lucky to have such amazing colleagues, and looking forward to talking it through in 2023.
This has been The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos. If you've been loving the show, one of the best ways you can support it is by leaving a review and rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps us find new listeners, and we read every review. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Eli Cohen. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Have a wonderful new year. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you in 2023.